Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, I'm Kirk Migu, host of Politics and Polemics on the New Books Network. I also host my own podcast called Independent Thought and Freedom, where I interview some of the most interesting people from around the world who are shaking up politics, economics, society, and ideas. You can find it in the iTunes Store or on any one of your favorite podcast providers. You can also subscribe to my YouTube channel. Also, are you an academic that wants to get heard nationally? Check out my free training on 3 steps how to use your intellectual authority to become a media personality at becomeapublicintellectual.com. That's becomeapublicintellectual.com. You can find the links below. And now, on to this week's episode. Hello. Today, my guest is Danny Haifong, co-author with Roberto Sirvent of American Exceptionalism and American Innocence, A People's History of Fake News, From the Revolutionary War to the War on Terror. Hi, Danny. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, congratulations on the book. It's been out for, about a year now?
Yes, a little over a year.
Right. Well, I see in the endorsement section at the front, you have some pretty high-level names there. A good couple pages. That's pretty good. You're really part of a network, aren't you?
Yes. It took a lot of work to get the book out to those folks like Cornel West and Michael Parenti, but we were so honored and happy that they decided to provide a blurb and to help get the book's message out there.
Yeah. Well, why don't you tell us, to start off, why don't you tell us a bit about yourself? And I suppose also how it's related to the topic of your book as well.
Sure. I think those two things are very related. So I am a journalist and an activist. I live in the New York City area. I grew up as a working class person on the East Coast of the United States. I'm part Vietnamese and a white American. And throughout my life, it was pretty clear that racism and class exploitation were two central issues in my own general just condition of life. But then also, over the course of my own history, I began to really politicize my understanding of the realities of injustice that exist in the United States and abroad. And I began to write for a Black Agenda Report, which is a Black left independent media journal that's online. And through my work with them, I learned that there is this insidious ideology of American exceptionalism, which is just so pervasive in the dominant narratives in the United States, how the U.S. political class and the ruling class talk and purvey our understandings about reality to us and about how we should think about not only the U.S. government, but the social system that we live in here, which causes so much terror, both here domestically and all around the world. So this book really got started when Roberto Servent emailed me after I'd been writing for Black and Gender Report for about 4 years. He emailed me saying that he was thinking about writing a book of short essays on the topic of American exceptionalism, but that he felt that Black Agenda Report's work needed to be a part of this project, and he wanted to elicit me to contribute to it. And so we began to talk about how that would work. He's a professor, you know, I'm a journalist and an activist, so we were really bringing together the academic world as well as, you know, the world of struggle against social justice on the ground, and attempting to really promote a message that people could understand, but also that wasn't just, you know, it wasn't just about intellectual exercising. It was really about trying to point a vision forward for activists and organizers and students and workers as well, to be able to understand their reality so they can be better equipped to transform it.
Right, right. So, so really it was kind of the work that you've been, it's kind of a culmination of the work you've been doing over the past, 4 years now? And the work that I, Roberto Servent has been doing. Interesting. Now, the title has, I think, three main concepts that I think it's important for us to understand and clarify. It's crucial to the whole series of narratives, because it's not like a monograph of one book from a beginning to end. As you said, it's like 21 essays, correct?
Yep. Yes.
Yeah. And the concepts that run throughout all of this is American exceptionalism and American innocence, and then fake news as well. But let's start off with American exceptionalism and American innocence. Could you explain it for the listeners, why it's important, and why you insist, as I see throughout the book, you know, that these ideas have to always be considered together?
Yes, we believe that both American exceptionalism and American innocence are really the dominant narratives that frame our understandings of all political issues, and are really the dominant ideologies that the U.S. ruling class employs to achieve its objectives of profiteering, exploitation, war, and oppression all around the world and in the United States as well. We define American exceptionalism as an ideology that presumes that the United States is a force for good in the world, and it positions the United States' development process as one that is marked by the very long-standing Western imperial notion that the West is the most civilized and advanced form of society that has ever come to be, and that the United States is actually the apex of Western civilization itself. While American innocence, on the other hand, while American exceptionalism really discusses the United States as an entity and a nation beyond and above all others, American innocence really kicks in and must be considered with American exceptionalism, because whenever the notion of American exceptionalism is challenged, there is usually a strong backlash to it, whether that is a rhetorical and ideological backlash or whether that's a real material backlash. And it usually takes the form of a defense of the sanctity of American exceptionalism by presuming that any wrongdoings, any criticisms against, let's say, U.S. empire around the world or white supremacy here in the United States, that these acts of injustice and oppression are really just aberrations in a longer process of moving toward a more perfect union. So in effect, American innocence helps apologize for any cracks that ever hit the armor of American exceptionalism itself. And so both of them are often employed together, because these debates are happening all the time and these struggles are happening all the time. And we wanted to highlight how there are two contending voices and two contending struggles always going on. And it's between those who are seeking to expose and to transform the conditions of oppression and exploitation, which the United States purveys all around the world, and which become heavily suppressed under the guise of American exceptionalism. And then there is the narrative of the ruling elites, which American exceptionalism, I think, wholly characterizes, where the United States is posited as this advanced, positive, and progressive force around the world, when in fact, all of the evidence points to the contrary. And we really wanted to highlight all of the different manifestations that we could think of as being the most critical examples of this.
Right, right. So when in your critique there, you what's interesting about it, and I think important, is that you are critiquing both the right and, well, let's say this, the right and the so-called left, or conservatives and liberals, for sharing the same framework. Is that right? Can you elaborate on that?
Yes, it's definitely on the mark. We really got motivated to write this book because there is a trend here, especially in the United States, but we believe it's very pervasive across the Western world. But here in the United States, there is this pervasive influence of American exceptionalism where even the most leftist currents in the United States, and this isn't just liberals, because we definitely ensure that our book primarily focuses on those who would consider themselves either sympathetic or along the Democratic Party's ideological spectrum, because we believe that's where the engine of American exceptionalism is. But it's not only that, it's those who claim to be even outside and more independent of that line of political thought and institution that still promote and fall into the trap of American exceptionalism by, let's say, focusing much more on the perceived otherization of countries around the world, for example, and falling into the narratives of the CIA and the US political class and the Pentagon generally about how those institutions talk about countries like China, countries like Syria and Libya, while saying nothing about the United States' role in creating catastrophes and failed states and having a real good reason to outright lie about what is going on around the world in order to achieve its primary objective of maintaining dominance and ensuring that nations all around the world kowtow to its interests. So we wrote this book in a lot of ways because of this trend on even the so-called far left, the so-called radical left, where the ideology of American exceptionalism is very strong. And we wanted to explain why that would be. And I think we have so many different avenues that we look at this issue around, whether it is our chapter on the repression of leftist movements in the United States and how that fed into the narrative of pro-Americanism, or whether it is looking at how our understandings of inclusion over the last 30 years have been weaponized by ruling class institutions like the media and academia to help engender and embed a particular way of looking at leadership and a particular way of looking at the way that we organize as more about public relations and more about getting in to office those who more represent us as oppressed people rather than looking at how the institutions themselves are oppressive inherently.
Right. I think your ideological stance is interesting and deserves some elaboration a bit more, because as you rightly say just now, I mean you interestingly say, let's say, you are criticizing not only mainstream conservatives and liberals, but even critiquing the, well, of course, the far right, but also the far left. And well, before I get go there, let me just clarify with you. Would you characterize your own work as being explicitly ideological?
I would, because I think that these times really call for an understanding of ideology and a real engagement with it. I think that, unfortunately, a lot of journalists who consider themselves as grounded in social movements and grounded in the struggle of the people tend to avoid the ideological aspect because it brings about a lot of criticism and sometimes even condemnation for attempting to chart a vision rather than just to illuminate the reality as it exists. It does take having both, having an understanding of why certain processes happen, as well as understanding the processes that are happening. So we definitely made this book explicitly ideological and actually focused on ideology first and foremost, because we felt that there's something missing right now. We talk about in our introduction how there was, and I think that this is still true here in year 2020, but in 2016, it was about a year plus before we began to write the book. There was this insurgent movement in the United States for very progressive demands like Medicare for All and a Green New Deal and to cancel student debt and things like that, that really stem from the Occupy Wall Street movement, which I, joined in a lot of ways during the 2011 uprising here in New York City. And those movements tend to die very quickly, especially within the grasp of the Democratic Party, whenever Democratic Party influence ends up seeping its way through these movements. And so we believe that there was a real need to talk about ideology because we felt that ideology was the missing element, you know, understanding and being able to analyze what is going on as it's happening, as well as being able to put that into historical, political, and economic context all at the same time is very important to strengthen movements. And we wanted this book to be about strengthening movements that want and seek to improve the lives of working class people and oppressed people, but just don't have the level of understanding yet to not fall into some of the traps that American exceptionalism and its purveyors, especially in the Democratic Party, lay out for us.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, when I asked the question, I certainly wasn't meaning ideological in a pejorative sense, but certainly people do mean that very often, especially in the mainstream, because you know an ideology sort of gives you a vision. And And a lot of people may not realize that they do have some sort of vision and therefore some sort of ideology, but they don't recognize it. And I think that's kind of something you're exposing here in the book. And by being explicitly ideological, I understand that there are dangers because then there are people who may automatically just dismiss you because of what, you know, they, you know, your ideology is declared as, and then they'd say you're subjective and you're just picking out facts to bolster your case. Let me ask you about that, because that's an interesting thing. I mean, as a journalist, you know, the mainstream, journalistic profession is, well, you know, it's just the facts. We need to be objective. We shouldn't be taking sides. Let the reader decide, et cetera, et cetera. And let's just seek out the truth, no matter where it takes us. And if people will criticize and have criticized ideological journalists as just using some facts conveniently and twisting things and turning it towards their ideological answers, because they have the answers predetermined already, and they're just looking to to bolster that and not even contradict their ideology. So how do you respond to people who might criticize ideologically based journalism, which I think you would agree, you know, you are part of, I don't know if you'd use that phrase, ideologically driven journalism, but you understand the question, I hope.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I do understand the question. Well, what I would say is that there is no way of escaping ideology as much as especially so-called mainstream journalists would like to believe, because in this moment of just unprecedented imperial monopolization, when you have so few corporations controlling much of the media around the world, when you have such a concentration of capital and power and wealth in the hands of so few people, and when you have so few countries really dictating the affairs of much of the world right now, there is no way to escape ideology, because you know, it is my belief, and I think that there's so much evidence to show that ideology is really built into the reality that we live in. So if we work for, let's say, the New York Times, then we are ultimately under the diktats of what the New York Times wants from us. We can see that journalists in the New York Times tend to have a hard time going outside of the lines of how the Pentagon and the CIA and the U.S. political class in general talks about foreign policy and foreign policy objectives. We never really hear the side of China or Syria or Libya and how they may be thinking about what the U.S. military does abroad. So there really is no way of escaping ideology, especially when we are living in a world where the struggle between contending classes and contending forces of power really do shape how we live just on a day-to-day basis, but also they shape the way that we think. And that's what this book tries to get at. It tries to get at the fact that we can be objective in the sense that we can go through an investigatory process which looks at the evidence of what happens during certain processes. We talk about the invasion of Korea, for example, killing millions of people, threatening nuclear war against China, and so many other disasters from that period. We also talk about the U.S.'s real role in World War II, which is backed up by so much evidence up to this point, not only using two nuclear bombs during that war, but also waiting hand and foot until the European world, as well as the Soviet Union, were damaged to the point where the United States could claim so-called global supremacy. That there's a lot of these calculations that often go missing, and a lot of these facts that often go missing because of ideology, because American exceptionalism and the elites and the ruling elites that wield it want to not only erase our historical memory, but they want to drive exactly how we understand history and material reality currently itself, that there is a concerted effort to ensure that our ability to analyze phenomenon is completely limited to already predetermined facts, like the United States, even if it creates tens of millions of premature deaths around the world due to war, even as it is the principal force for the most heinous wealth inequality that we may have ever seen in human history, even as it parades and peddles white supremacist ideology in the United States and all across the world to demonize and dehumanize a large section of the global population, even after all of these things, the torture, complete destruction of entire societies, that the United States is still the best that we have. And I believe that that itself is a very ideological phenomenon that most journalists at this moment, especially here in the United States, where so few corporations own the entire media, that's the ideological line that they walk on, and whether they like to admit it or not.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think it's important to point out the ideological basis of all journalism, especially those that toe the line. Not, I wouldn't say toe the line, but those who talk about objectivity as if there is no ideology there. There is, and it's important to be explicit about it. And ideology is something I'm very interested in general. And I think the ideology behind your book, or that informs your book, isn't that behind it, is really, you know, it pervades it. It goes all throughout. I notice a few things there that are interesting that I'd like you to elaborate on. But let me let you say what your perhaps influences are and how you would describe your ideology. Can you elaborate on that for us?
Sure. The influences on my ideology really stem from the global struggle against imperialism, as well as the revolutionary struggle here in the United States, especially for self-determination. The struggle for self-determination of Black Americans in the United States has been wholly influential to me, because I do come from a country which has an over century-long history battling with foreign powers, and that's Vietnam, battling with foreign powers to achieve independence and dignity and the right to develop on its own terms. And so those struggles, the struggle abroad for emancipation from colonialism and imperialism, these systems that shape racism and these understandings of American exceptionalism that we talk about, as well as the domestic struggle here in the United States, the class struggle as well, to fight power head on and to organize and try to envision a new society. That is really what has inspired me to write this book and to continue to write in general, to try to synthesize new ideas that are rooted in history and rooted in this people's struggle for a new society that's based on human need rather than the private profits of the few, which I believe is the principal struggle and principal contradiction which shapes so many of the problems that we see and the problems that constantly get buried and distorted and misunderstood because of this very pervasive ideology of American exceptionalism, which discredits and attempts to glorify a society that is rooted in slavery and rooted in genocide and rooted in this really sordid history that has yet to be reckoned with and has yet to be understood as something that lives on to this day, that there was no social revolution in the United States. There hasn't been a reformation of the ways in which this society works. What are the fundamental drivers of so-called U.S. progress? And just experiencing that personally through, you know, personal economic struggles, as well as being a longtime target of racism. There's still a lot, as we're seeing with the COVID-19 pandemic, there's still a lot of racism and white supremacy thrown at Asian Americans as well. And just my lifelong struggle to attempt to unite people across not only this country, but just countries around the world, to fight this, what I believe is a common enemy, which is this concentrated wealth and power in the hands of so few, is really what drove me to write the book, as well as just drives my ability and desire to continue to do projects like this, which focus on helping bring all of us to a higher level of understanding so we can actually organize a higher level of political activity that's more effective than what's going on right now.
Yeah. Definitely going through your book and listening to you just now, particularly the critique of the right and the left. Yeah, I totally see the influence of particularly the Black nationalist critique of America, which had a long history, you know, Malcolm X being perhaps the primary person, you know, but goes, you know, I suppose even Garvey and stuff, but certainly Malcolm X's critique of the right and the left, the Black nationalist critique of America itself. And well, you mentioned the self-determination of Black Americans. Yeah, there's definitely that I see, and it's interesting. But and then you're also, would you call yourself Marxist or not?
I would say so. You know, these terms can be very, you know, very broad. And I think many people have so many ways of understanding them, depending on their own political affiliation. But for myself, you know, Marx and the works of Marxism, depending on which works they are, have been so influential too, because really, the whole weight of the oppressive apparatus that we talk about, the system of imperialism that we talk about, and the ideology of American exceptionalism is geared towards suppressing these works, and suppressing not only the works, but also what the works were analyzing, because a lot of people believe, I think wrongly, that, you know, Marxism is really rooted in this intellectual exercise of trying to understand political economy. But when you actually do read the works, you realize that a lot of them are grounded in trying to understand political economy from what working people and oppressed people were doing on the ground at that point. I mean, you know, reading Ho Chi Minh and how influential his work has been on me, you see just the complete commitment to connecting the struggle to free Vietnam from colonialism to trying to understand and outline a path forward that's based on what is this struggle really all about. And I think that's what we try to emulate in the book, is this idea that, yes, we can put down the facts. We can also analyze certain phenomenon. Like, we go through the Obama period pretty deeply in chapters 17 and 18 as well. And we didn't just do that to outline, look at all these horrible things that the Obama administration did, but we wanted to say why they were done in this way and how it was so effective and why it was so effective. And so I think we try to take that kind of approach throughout everything that we talk about in the book.
Yeah, definitely. In terms of the Marxism too, I mean, the whole tradition of Black Marxism is also very important, and I see that I see that in your work, and it reminds me of some kind of stuff, the Pathfinder. I don't know if you know those publishers, mm-hmm. but in the 60s and 70s, and they publish a lot of Malcolm X's stuff. Yeah, and, you know, and tying it into the global struggle. I mean, I always find it quite amusing when people call Malcolm X a civil rights leader, mm-hmm. because his whole argument was against civil rights and for human rights, and they misunderstand the radical nature of his critique, which I think your book really takes up. You know, it really takes up in a modern way, and, you know, as you said, you know, even taking it to a critique of the Obama administration. I mean, there are, let me just take, you have 21 essays looking at, you know, various aspects of history, of culture. Why don't you explain the way you organized those 21 chapters and the types of topics and issues you've chosen?
Sure. So we organized the book pretty consciously to kind of highlight various aspects of American exceptionalism, at least those aspects that frame our understanding of imperialism and capitalism and racism. We go first through our introduction of what it is, and we use examples through history, and we try to use American exceptionalism as a way to debunk myths by talking about how the ideology presents certain aspects of history. Let's say the process of the American, so-called American Revolution itself. And we write about these historical processes as being not only so mythologized by American exceptionalism, but also we go through the reality of what actually happened during these periods. We talk about the Korean War, we talk about World War II, we talk about the so-called American Revolution being a struggle to preserve slavery rather than to free the so-called colonies here in the North American mainland from the yoke of the British monarchy. So we talk about these historical instances to show that there really was a concerted effort to create a narrative which supported the underlying objectives of all of these processes, which was to actually consolidate power and to make a more effective form of imperialism and white supremacy and capitalism that are so relevant today. Then we move on to certain topics that at the time especially were so influential over the political discourse, but which significantly highlighted how American exceptionalism is really an ideology of white supremacy, and that this ideology is supported and ultimately wielded by not just people like Donald Trump, right-wing ranchivist racists, but also the so-called enlightened Democratic Party liberal, you could call them left, but really they're firmly on the political right at this point. But we talk about issues like the Charlottesville protest of the so-called Unite the Right activists, these far-right, alt-right forces who were, you know, marching on Charlottesville. There was a violent protest, but then the so-called opposition to Trump, the so-called resistance, you know, ultimately caved to the notion of American exceptionalism by trying to unite all Americans, quote unquote, around the idea that these protests didn't represent what the United States was all about. And that gave Donald Trump the leverage to say, well, if we're going to take down statues of people like Robert E. Lee, then we're going to have to do it of Thomas Jefferson and George Washington because they were all slave owners. So we talk about this dynamic of how liberals and conservatives, right wingers and so-called neoliberals and Democrats really do, you know, reinforce each other in the sense that they kind of carry the same objectives policy-wise, but use American exceptionalism in different ways in order to achieve them. So right now, we believe that the liberals and the Democrats are interested most in preserving this American exceptionalist image, while the right wing is more interested in talking about how far astray the United States has gone from this exceptionalist image, and they're trying to redeem it through right-wing and racist imperatives. So we talk about this throughout the book. We talk about how the like the attack on Colin Kaepernick, for example, and the way that the Black Lives Matter movement devolved in so many ways represents this critical struggle of you know, forces trying to either be independent of American exceptionalism or falling into its trap. We also have many chapters later on about the economic aspect of American exceptionalism, this American dream narrative, which just completely distorts our understanding of capitalism and the crisis that it has created for so many working people, especially Black workers here in the United States, and that this American dream narrative has created so much disillusionment amongst the population because it is so far flung from the reality on the ground. And then later on, we take a more focus on foreign policy, imperialism, and we also highlight certain critical issues like Russiagate, for example, or this so-called identity politics trend here in the United States, which we call more the politics of inclusion, which we believe has been so detrimental to our ability to understand not only what real progressive and radical leadership should be and should look like, but also it has been wielded by the ruling elites to make more effective evils, to make leaders who are even that much more subservient to the imperatives of imperialism, but also so much more effective in being able to achieve them and to be able to worsen the conditions on the ground for us. And we really highlight Obama, the Barack Obamas, the Hillary Clintons, And this was a time before she has basically lost all legitimacy into so many. But we really highlight how this trend of inclusion has also gone hand in hand with the decline in living standards and the escalation of endless wars, and basically just the complete expansion of all of the most oppressive features of U.S. imperialism, which have gone largely unquestioned because now there are so many political leaders who are believed to represent us as folks who are victims of this system. And we believe that it was so important to just highlight how that was operating and how American exceptionalism operates to reinforce this notion that representation is the most important aspect of our struggle, and that if we can just make the United States look and feel like the society it has always been said to be, then somehow we are going to make our way out of this condition, these deplorable and disastrous conditions that we find ourselves in.
Right. I forgot, you know, in the ideology part, to bring this in, the other person I see, in a sense, haunting your work, to use that sort of communist manifesto metaphor, is Noam Chomsky, manufacturing of consent and his whole critique, you know, from way back about the role of the media in American imperialism, both the right and the left. I guess two questions I have is how influential was that on you? Do you have any differences with his opinion? And then how does this, because that's how I understand your bringing up the idea of fake news. And then how does this concept of fake news tie into all the things you were just talking about throughout your book?
Yes. Well, we take an interesting conception of fake news because we do go over bit of the history of how that term was deployed, how both the Obama and Clinton wing of the Democratic Party really did raise the term as a threat to their own kind of stranglehold on the dominant narrative of American exceptionalism, where they blamed online activity as spreading fake news to undermine their own political legitimacy. And then Donald Trump ended up taking it and running with it in a much more effective way for himself. But our conception of fake news is different in the sense that we believe not only does the ruling class just have an extensive history of lying, and actually that's probably what they're most effective at doing, but also that this ideology of American exceptionalism and its counterpart, American innocence, really are fake news in and of themselves, that they represent an ideological strand of the ruling class and an ideological weapon of the ruling class, which inherently spreads myths and erases historical memory to ensure that the real fake news, i.e. beliefs in the U.S.'s inherent superiority, the commitment to the United States as a human rights purveyor rather than a purveyor of violence, as Martin Luther King would have put it, there are these pervasive ideologies that actually represent fake news themselves. And we, didn't take directly from Noam Chomsky. We are pretty familiar with his work. We wanted to offer something that was a little more complex in the sense that we not only uncovered these lies that have been promoted as truths from the ruling class, and just the reality behind them, the massive destruction in instances such as the U.S. NATO invasion of Libya, or whether we're talking about the decline of capitalism, American capitalism, and how that has been so devastating for working people. We not only uncover these devastating aspects of American exceptionalism and the system that it defends. But we also decided that it was important to talk about just why this occurs, because I believe that even though it's really easy to say, well, powerful people are protecting power, we try to outline, well, what exactly is that power? And we really defined it as the power to maintain a system predicated upon the private profits of a few, but also the power to be able to shape the narrative in service of that objective, to be able to create a material reality such as mass incarceration and police violence and the otherization of entire peoples in order to maintain and expand on this sense of white humanity and imperial humanity, which allows and justifies all of the most heinous aspects, policies, and conditions that imperialism led by the United States employs around the world. So in some ways, we are influenced by Chomsky, but we try to go a little further in our conclusion.
Yeah. I mean, certainly, since he wrote the whole postmodern, Foucauldian and Derrida, look at discourse has deepened and developed. And yeah, and definitely bringing understanding the nature of power in a lot more subtle ways is definitely part of your narrative, I think. And, there are many topics, as you talked about there, that you cover, things like the American Revolution. I'm very interested in your argument about how it was there to preserve slavery, because in the British Empire, the former British Empire where I'm located, slavery was abolished in 1834, which is much before the United States, and that's interesting, the whole movement here and how America was actually pretty late in abolishing slavery. And you have things like the Korean War, Charlottesville, Black Lives Matter, billionaire capitalists, US human rights, humanitarian sort of liberal interventionism, blame Russia, Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, and their politics. So you have all these very interesting topics. Which ones of them do you think are probably the most important ones that you've looked at in terms of that? People would say, wow, I never really thought of that before, or I never saw it. I know your book is full of that, but are there any ones that stand out?
Wow, that's a really good question. I would say that you named some of them, but I would say that our chapter, the third chapter about was the American Revolution, revolutionary for slaves, I believe is a very important one, because it really synthesizes the great work of Gerald Horne in outlining this extensive history of what the colonialists and the capitalists who were really the driving force of the so-called American Revolution, what they were thinking, the stupendous profits that they were making from the trade in slaves, as well as just the larger geopolitical context. There was this larger geopolitical context where not only was domestically were there these huge insurrections in places like Antigua, Jamaica, in the Caribbean, but also there was this external force of contending empires, Spanish, the French, the Dutch. They were all fighting with the British monarchy for possession of these colonies. And this system of slavery, which required an entire class of people, Africans, to be enslaved at the behest of a very small white minority, was actually creating a lot of problems for the British Empire and the British monarchy. And so there was this move not only to arm Africans to defend, create a buffer class to defend colonies like Antigua. But there was also this move to consider the abolition of the slave trade, not necessarily of slavery, but of the slave trade because of how costly it was to the British Empire in maintaining these colonies at the rate that they were expanding, like in the North American mainland. And so when this trend was observed by colonialists, many of whom were escaping from places like Cuba and Antigua for respite because there was actually a white majority in the North American mainland, it was one of the few, it was, you know, in places like Georgia, which was literally founded as a white colony to buffer from the Spanish Florida's incursions of arming Africans to try to take more territory. There was this trend towards abolition of the trade, which was seen as so threatening to the interests of North American colonialists that are perceived to be now the founding fathers. And this was all, this all culminated in the Somerset case of 1772, where an escaped slave made their way to the shores of London and was found under English common law to have the right to be free on the territory. All of that is so important to understanding how this origins myth, which is really connected to American exceptionalism, this idea that the American Revolution was a progressive step in history, is actually not only outright false, but it actually helps to erase the current existence of Black Americans today, the current condition of Black America today, where so many of these afterlives of slavery continue to plague Black people, whether it's through mass incarceration, through the police violence, through the discrimination in employment, the mass unemployment, having double, triple the rates of poverty of white Americans. All of this is still rooted in this origins myth that continues to erase these realities that Black Americans continue to face. And then I think our take on foreign policy generally, so I think that there are folks who are against wars for sure, but there are not a lot of people here in the United States that understand what these wars are really all about. And by going into, for example, World War II, which is probably the most mythologized war and probably the most important war for American exceptionalism, by going into the details, the historical record about, well, how come U.S. corporations like Ford and GM, et cetera, IBM, why were they financing Nazism prior to it taking power in Germany? Why was it that the United States waited so long to enter the war at all? Why was it that there was so much talk about Nazism being a very useful bulwark against the Soviet Union, even while Europe was getting pummeled by that same Nazist force abroad? And why is it that after the United States entered, it really just caused more devastation and destruction and didn't do much in the way of fighting Nazism like, let's say, the Soviet Union did, sacrificing 27 million people for the cause of preventing Nazism and preventing the Hitler regime from being able to spread its tentacles around the world, where the Soviet Union was seen as the primary marker of what that would be. And that was actually Nazism's principal objective, was to overthrow the Soviet Union. And the United States shared that in many ways. So a lot of the activities that the U.S. participated in during World War II were actually meant to intimidate the Soviet Union. And we talk about the firebombing of Dresden, which killed upwards of 150,000 people, although there are many who want to say it was just 10,000 or 15,000. But there are observers who say it was at least 100 times that amount. And then you think about the nuclear bombs that were dropped on Japan and how those were wholly unnecessary. And there's extensive historical record that shows that they were just dropped to demonstrate to the Soviet Union what the U.S.'s air capacity was all about and what could happen if the Soviet Union decided that it was the top dog on the geopolitical, you know, in the geopolitical realm. So we believe that our ability to understand just how mythologized foreign policy of the United States has been over the course of especially the last 70 years, but also just throughout the course of history, and how it's so important in uncovering American exceptionalism as the ideology that it is, and that it, you know, and how it protects these powerful interests that a lot of people still think are pretty democratic, especially in the arena of World War II and that aspect of history. Everyone wants to be a part of this trend where, yes, fascism was defeated and U.S. democracy liberated the world. And guess what? Wages increased in the United States as well because of the war economy and the struggle for labor. That there's a lot of this, that there's a lot of this romanticism about, especially that period of history, which I think we do a pretty good job of showing that not only was it still principally exclusionary for oppressed peoples like Black Americans, but also it was a period of great strife and of great imperial treachery waged by the United States for its own objectives, and that whatever struggles occurred that actually improved the condition of working people need to be credited to working people and oppressed people themselves, and not the ruling class, which, as we have seen over the last 40 years, will take away any gains that have been made at the behest of capital when the time is right.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, those are very interesting things. And I mean, those topics fit in so much into my own interests, like even, say, the American Revolution. And I mean, the American colonies and the West Indian colonies were not really differentiated, and I mean the wealth of New York and Boston, I mean, was predicated on the molasses grown right here in the West Indies where I am, and when you look at the whole creation of America and the Americans' understanding of its history, I as a Caribbean person, whenever I go there, I'm actually quite surprised at how ignorant they are about the foundations of their country. Yeah, so that's a very interesting point, I think. And yeah, the World War II thing, because, I mean, after World War II, that's when America became the superpower. And so that's very interesting. I don't know if you see that as sort of accidental, or if that was something much more planned out. But before World War II, America was not, the world power it was afterward. So does that figure into your analysis there?
For sure. We definitely talk about and focus a lot on the period when the United States became a superpower, because this was when the ideology of American exceptionalism could really build inroads globally. But in the United States, this ideology becomes so pervasive at this time because of the ways in which the domestic situation changed. You had a scenario where working people have been struggling, waging strikes, organizing unions, building a real movement to demand improved conditions. And the war economy, the imperialist war economy, was able to provide that for a time by becoming a superpower and by looting the rest of the world and creating more favorable conditions for workers here. And that, especially white American workers. And so that dynamic allowed American exceptionalism, especially this notion of the American dream, to become so embedded in the framework of how even working class people understand the United States, because there still is to this day, despite the complete and utter decline that the empire is experiencing, that capitalism is experiencing, and that so many people have been devastated by, there is still this idea that, well, at least we're not over in, let's say, China, or over in Vietnam, or over on the African continent, or in the Caribbean, or anywhere else in the world where actually poverty is a lot worse and conditions are a lot worse and there are just autocrats and dictators over there, that it really was when the U.S. became this so-called imperial superpower, where its framework for democracy as being a democracy superior to all others and a form of society that was head and shoulders human versus the rest of the so-called third world, the socialist world, as well as just peoples in the United States who represented those potential scourges, there was this ability to globalize that dichotomy and that contradiction, which still has a lot of consequences today. So this moment from 1945 on, where the United States becomes the imperial superpower, becomes the capitalist superpower, and is able to wield its influence in such a way where it normalizes it without a real competitor, although during the 45 to 91, there was a socialist bloc, and that was a big reason why this ideology became so much more important. It has taken a toll on the consciousness of working people and working class people. I was just looking at a poll yesterday that showed that 54% of people in the United States believe that China should pay reparations to the U.S. for the coronavirus, that there is this superiority, entitlement, and belief that the United States has the right to demand and to shape, to demand from other countries anything that it wants and to shape the narrative in any way that it wants, which is so pervasive and so damaging, I think, to our ability to wage solidarity, build solidarity with others, and to build effective movements against the forces that are causing all of the injustice that we see in the world.
Yeah, you know, your narrative is explicitly against this idea that America is working towards a more perfect union, and it may have started flawed, but you know, we're fixing it, right? That's kind of basically both the liberal and conservative, And I suppose in many ways the far left narrative that they have, which you can call a kind of ideology in a sense. Now, but you in your book you are basically saying that this whole mythology, and I suppose propaganda, which is, you know, fake news, of American exceptionalism and American innocence has been there from the beginning. It continues now, and there seems no let up, except, you know, certain struggles here and there. What it appears to, and I know that the book, as you state in the introduction, and you stated here, is not just an academic book. It's for activists. It's for political organizers, community workers, etc., to think about their condition. So taking this line that inherently the United States has this flaw, right? That is it, that it can never be erased, and what has to happen is that America as we understand it has to be, in a sense, destroyed or overthrown. So does that make this like an anti-American book, or how do you how would you characterize it? Do you think that's an unfair conclusion that I've drawn?
Well, I think that the idea of anti-Americanism is, and we talk about it in the book, is rooted in these ideologies and understanding that America is somehow defined as the way that the U.S. ruling class defines it, which is this democratic arbiter of liberty and freedoms for all, where it has some sort of sanctimonious right to these values, but also to the ability to ward off any criticism and do whatever it likes around the world and here in the United States. So, you know, we talk about this and we say that our book is not anti-American in the sense that we are condemning people in the United States who are living here who may be taken by these ideologies and really are invested in the exceptionalism of the United States. There are many good, even well-meaning activists who believe that if we just take hold of these values and make sure that they are lived by, then we can actually live in the world that supposedly the forefathers had ascribed to them. So we talk about our book as anti-American in the sense that we are against the system that American exceptionalism defends, and we are against the narrative of Americanism, which posits that it's okay for certain sections of the world population, nations around the world, people who are considered non-white, this racist depiction of the United States as an arbiter of liberty, what Thomas Jefferson called an empire of liberty, that has the right to genocidally wipe out indigenous people and suppress their current existence, to keep Black Americans in a state of wealthlessness and state oppression and devastating amounts of poverty, that the working class in general around the world can be plundered at any rate that the United States deems fit through its financial institutions, just because the United States has the right and is ultimately the only alternative that people around the world have to look towards when it comes to any sort of development. And I think it's that which we reject, that the racism, the white supremacy, that American exceptionalism inherently purveys, and the real material manifestations of this ideology and empire and racism and capitalist exploitation, which we believe are the foundation. So if it is the foundation, then we need to be able to let go of the ideas and the myths that American exceptionalism has promoted, and be able to look with clear eyes at what this system is all about and what we need to do to create an actual democracy, to create an actual society where freedoms like certain human rights as healthcare and education and employment and peace are prioritized.
Just out of curiosity, I know this can take us down a long road, and I know we don't have time, but I am curious. Do you think that electing Bernie Sanders would have been a positive step in your view? I'd really like to know that in terms of your framework of thinking, your ideology. So, you know, would electing Bernie Sanders help this? Would that have helped it at all?
What I will say about this, because we do talk about, unfortunately, we, you know, published this book in 2019, but a lot of our analysis is 2017, 2018, so post-2016 Bernie Sanders campaign. We talk about it more as a phenomenon that points into a very positive trend where socialism is becoming more popular as a word. But we still talked about it as it is rooted, this new socialist consciousness, it's rooted in a New Deal kind of politics, which reinforces American exceptionalism in a lot of ways, which is why Bernie Sanders had his own fundamental flaws that were exposed even more so in 2020 when he decided to place Democratic Party unity and the unity with the political establishment over his own grassroots base. And we believe that that is just a fundamental flaw of what he was trying to do. And so, your question to me is more about whether it was really possible for the system to accept a Bernie Sanders. And I think the past two elections have shown that the ruling class here in the United States has no interest in any sort of social welfare agenda, even among someone like Bernie Sanders, who was not calling for a revolution. He was calling for a 21st century New Deal. And so if he were to be elected in the hypothetical sense, if we were talking about ideally, sure, yeah. I think that the movement behind him would have been energized, would have been inspired and motivated to hold him accountable. I really do believe that in a lot of ways. However, unfortunately, because the system was never designed to or had any interest in allowing him to win, which I believe, if all things were fair and square, could have been a possibility, but because they were so committed to suppressing his movement, I don't believe that it was actually possible for it to happen. And that is something that I think his forces, the people who support him, really have to think about. And we try to push forward, well, why is it that the ruling class at this moment is so committed to stymieing any sort of social welfare agenda, even if it is narrowly just for U.S. workers and narrowly for people here in the United States who are struggling living paycheck to paycheck? Why is there so much opposition to that amongst the ruling elite? And I think Bernie Sanders has done a big service in his last two elections in unearthing American exceptionalism in a lot of ways, in showing that, well, working people are actually living in devastating conditions and conditions that are not fit for human life. And there is this ruling class that is committed to keeping that in place. But Bernie Sanders himself is not committed to challenging that ruling class to the point of production and the point of power. So we, in effect, his movement that he has led has been kind of held back by him as a political leader who still wants the status quo to exist. He just wants the status quo to be on the right path. So he himself, as well as the people who advised him and the people who really helped formulate his campaign, unfortunately fell into the American exceptionalist trap. And I think it's a big lesson in, well, what's the next step that must be taken for these forces, these young people who definitely, especially a lot of these young workers, I know a few of them, they are infuriated by this situation. And whether they believed Bernie Sanders could have helped if he was elected, I think would be answered as a wholehearted yes. But the establishment is designed in a certain way to prevent it. And Bernie Sanders showed that he had allegiances to that establishment himself.
I think you're absolutely right. And I do think that your book sort of exposing this underlying ideology does explain some of the contradictions that, you know, Sanders kind of undermined himself purposely in many ways, it seemed. You know, Joe Biden is my friend all the time, you know. I think that's right. If to kind of move to a close here, you know, to sum up the book, I suppose, after a reader has gone through your, you know, your extensive and wide-ranging and fundamental critique, what would be the one thing you'd like them to leave with?
I think what I would like people to leave with our book is to really place the solidarity with people around the world as a principal need and focus of our struggle for social justice to come, that there is also a need, and I think this is very interrelated to placing solidarity at the forefront of our movements, a need to really place white supremacy too when it comes to American exceptionalism and at the forefront, and to challenge all of the ruling class, not just the Trumps of the world, but really place the entire ruling class on trial for their reinforcement of the completely heinous conditions that Black people and oppressed people of various nationalities face in the United States. Because without doing so, our movements are so much weaker, and they only sow distrust amongst peoples whose movements have generally been the arc of progress, of real actual progress in the United States, both ideologically and material, and that would be the Black Liberation Movement. But in terms of an overarching takeaway, I would say that our book, because we focus so much on debunking the racist myths behind American exceptionalism, that we hope that by understanding these, that more people, especially in this Bernie Sanders wing of the grassroots working class behind his campaign, but also people generally will be able to see solidarity and see the principal need to defend countries from imperialism first before going into any sort of condemnation or critique of countries abroad, will formulate, especially countries abroad that the U.S. doesn't like, that will help formulate more effective path for our struggles here in the United States, that there are so many friends that we have around the world who are willing to, you know, join us in demanding that the United States be held to account for its war crimes, as well as for the war crimes that are hitting communities right here at home. I do think that there is a possibility for that. It's just that here in the United States, we don't have any forces that are willing to put in that kind of work and that are willing to make it happen.
Okay, great. Are you working on anything right now that you'd like to let our listeners know about?
Sure. So, you know, I continue to write weekly for blackagendareport.com. So you can always catch my work there. But right now I am working on a journal article for World Review of Political Economy about American exceptionalism in the age of COVID-19, talking about the U.S. response to COVID-19, both on the domestic and international arenas, and how they really signal that American exceptionalism has been unmasked as an ideology that protects private capital, the interests of private capital alone, and that show that the United States is designed to exacerbate pandemics rather than to bring some sort of democracy, liberty, and freedom to any section of the population other than the ruling class. So I'm working on that right now, and hopefully we'll have that out as soon as the academic world allows.
Oh, great. Well, that sounds great. So the book is American Exceptionalism and American Innocence, A People's History of Fake News from the Revolutionary War to the War on Terror. Danny Haifeng, thanks so much for this interview. It's been a pleasure.
I appreciate you having me, Kirk. Thank you.
That's all for Politics and Polemics this week. If you like this, remember to check out my other podcast, Independent Thought and Freedom, and subscribe to my YouTube channel. Also, if you are an academic and want to get heard nationally, check out my free training at becomeapublicintellectual.com. Thanks, and see you next week.